Well, the real reason that you've been sent over here is because they wanted you to be evaluated.
Yeah.
To determine whether or not you're mentally ill. You're going to be here for a period for us to evaluate you.
We're going to study you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make our determinations as to what we're going to do.
Right.
And give you the necessary treatment.
Let me just tell you this. I'm here to cooperate with you 100%. 100%. I'll be just right down the line with you. You watch. Because I think we ought to get to the bottom of R.P. McMurphy.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's review of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Show these guys who's nuts.
A patron-exclusive review, chosen by Sean Ray.
If that's what being crazy is, then I'm senseless, out of it, gone down the road wacko.
Hosted by Jacob.
Said you've been belligerent, talked when unauthorized.
Arnie.
I fight and fuck too much.
And Stuart.
I don't think he's overly psychotic.
You think he's dangerous?
Absolutely so.
This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language.
Arnie, why don't you knock off the bullshit and get to the point?
Listener discretion is advised.
Giving up?
No, just warming up.
We hope you enjoy the show.
All right, gentlemen, let's begin.
Today, we're discussing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, starring Jack Nicholson, Louise Fletcher, and William Redfield, directed by Milos Forman. This is the Now Playing co-host of Which a Little Dabble Do Ya, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host who fights and fucks too much, sometimes at the same time, Jacob.
It's the best way, man.
That's how you get in an asylum.
So welcome back, patrons, for a second dab of exclusive reviews this month in May. This is another patron pick from Sean Ray, a name that you've heard quite a bit if you've been listening to our patron shows. Sean is a wonderful patron of Now Playing and has now picked a Grand Slam Oscar winner. It won all five of the big ones.
Only three movies have done that. It Happened One Night, Silence of the Lambs, and this one. Best Picture, Best Director, Actor, Actress, Script. But is that why he picked it? What did Sean say?
Well, he really liked what we did with Amadeus, which he called Milos Forman's other masterpiece. So there's that, and Jack Nicholson is Sean's favorite actor ever.
Okay.
Not that all of his films are good.
Well, I mean, no actors is.
And he had just rewatched this back when he picked this movie and fell in love with it all over again. And he really liked how evil and subtly evil he saw Nurse Ratched as. So he wanted to hear us talk about it. And he's wondering, how did Michael Douglas get to be a producer of this film? Which is a nice little bit of trivia. I remember when I was doing some research for, I think it was Ant-Man, the first one, and I had Michael Douglas talking about how he'd won an Oscar for this movie because he was the producer.
Yeah, his first Oscar. Yep.
It's because this was a passion project of his dad's. His dad wanted to make this film and star in it. And by the time they got around to making it, Kurt Douglas had gotten too old. And so Kurt made a deal with his son. Why don't you go off and try to get this thing made?
Oh, yeah. This has a long production history, starting with the novel. I mean, it should be said, how familiar are you with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in any version?
I'm very familiar with the film. I've probably seen it half dozen times ever since high school. But yeah, the fact that there's a book, had no idea, and apparently there's a Broadway play?
Yeah, all of this is interconnected. There's one exists because of the other, yes. 1962 novel, I think this is one of the rare cases where a classic book is also considered a classic movie. Typically, they get screwed up, right? You either take a pulp novel and turn it into Jaws, or you take a great book and like it isn't as good. But this one is one where you can truly argue movie may be just as good or better than the 1962 novel, which I read for the first time for this viewing. I've seen Cuckoo's Nest a few times. I don't go back to it a lot. I wouldn't say a half dozen times, but maybe every 12 years, I catch this one. And yes, this time I wanted to have the book perspective in my mind.
I first saw this in psychology class junior year of high school. My psychology teacher loved to show us films.
So before you saw The Dark Overlords?
Yes. Mm. That was in college. But she showed us Clockwork Orange to discuss Pavlovian responses.
In high school? The whole film?
Yeah. It was a Catholic school, so she'd pause it during certain scenes and fast forward and basically summarize what happened.
She'd edit it for you.
Yes. And she showed us this, and I absolutely loved this film upon watching it. I am a Jack Nicholson fan from childhood. Ever since he scared the shit out of me with The Shining, I've been fascinated with his performances. And because I was so enamored with this movie, I immediately went out, I read that book. So when I was 16 years old, I read the book. I have faint memories of it. I probably returned to this movie every other year for the next decade, and then have watched it a handful of times in the 20 years since then. But it's a movie I'm very familiar with, and when I saw Sean put it on there, I was excited. I love it when I get to talk about a film that I truly have nothing but pure adulation for.
I didn't realize this was one of your favorites.
Yeah, it's the cast that we've got here. I mean, it is the best gathering of character actors in cinematic history, I dare say.
Yeah, like, were these people anyone before this film? Like, I'm always surprised. Like, oh, Danny DeVito? Christopher Lloyd? Like, just everyone's popping up in this thing. Brad Dourif?
Yeah, they booked Taxi out of this.
Yeah, Danny DeVito, one of his first roles, I guess he got this because this blows my mind. I can't picture in the early 70s Danny DeVito rolling with Michael Douglas in Hollywood, but they were buds.
Well, Michael Douglas was a TV star. It should be said he wasn't a leading man. He wasn't anything. He was Kirk Douglas's kid.
Right, but I just can't picture Danny DeVito rolling with that.
They were both in TV.
He wasn't at this point, though. He would go on to TV.
I'm sure he had guest spots in Maude or something.
And then this is Christopher Lloyd's first role. I mean, so many of these got careers out of this movie. But yeah, as we go through the characters, there's probably only one or two of these people who I just don't absolutely love from other roles and here.
Yeah, the teacher from Better Off Dead's going to show up, whatever his name is.
Oh, he's got a great name. His name is Vincent Schiavelli, and I know him from Ghost, Batman Returns, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Lord of Illusions.
Yeah, I just, that face, you put him in scary stuff.
But Stuart, I can't remember the book. Were these characters as colorful on the page as these actors made them on the screen?
I'll just go ahead and put it out there. I wasn't totally in love with this book. I know it's a classic. I know that people adored it. Again, the reason why it got made was it was a counterculture hit. I think what's interesting about it was written in 1962, but wouldn't get made into a movie until 1975. Ken Kesey, the author, he was a student at Stanford that agreed to a CIA-funded LSD study at a VA hospital.
Can I sign up?
Yeah, well, back then, they wanted to know what this whole acid thing was and whether they needed to arrest Timothy Leary or not. But yes, he was at the VA, taking LSD with people in the psych ward, and got a job there and ended up, you know, he wanted to be a writer. It helped pay the bills. He saw a lot of stuff. He saw lobotomies. He saw cruelty. He saw over-medication. It became all the fodder for his first novel, which is Cuckoo's Nest. And yeah, they're very similar in terms of plot points, book and movie. But for one thing, the book is told in first person entirely from the perspective of the Indian chief.
The character that doesn't talk? Is it blank pages?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Ken Kesey wrote the first draft of this, and the whole movie was going to be narrated by the chief. And he was going to very much keep that perspective. He loves it. It's difficult, though, because the character is either mentally ill or overly medicated. He goes in and out of hallucinations. So you can never be totally sure about what's real or not. You'll have a scene from the movie like the World Series or whatever, and then he'll have a hallucination that the orderlies are cutting people's heads off and pulling out wires and stuff like that. So the whole ward he thinks is being run by a combine motor. So it's a little bit more trippy. I wondered if maybe that was even part of the title, like it was a cuckoo clock although it felt like it was a machine that was running this asylum. But yeah, 1962, Vietnam hadn't happened yet. We hadn't had, like, all the things that I associate with this movie, like the metaphors and what have you, like, this is at the forefront of that. The anger that people would have at the establishment, it's probably why it wouldn't have gotten made back in 1963 when it was published. Kirk Douglas optioned it, as you said, for himself and said the only way that they're going to make it as a movie is if I make it as a play. I have to star in Broadway as McMurphy here. And unfortunately, it opened a few days before Kennedy was shot. So it closed real quick and there was no movie with Kirk Douglas. But again, I think they're lucky for that for lots of reasons. For one thing, he wanted to make it with Richard Rush directing, who did such a wonderful job with Mental Illness on the Bruce Willis movie Color of Night. Oh, you covered that. Imagine that. But I also just want to point out, in 1963-64, Hollywood is making The Music Man, My Fair Lady. Like, it doesn't really make the counterculture dark projects. Again, Vietnam hadn't happened. The youth movement demanded a new style of movie in the late 60s. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest would not have made sense as a studio picture. It makes much more sense as the raw indie movie that, yes, when Kirk Douglas couldn't make it, he handed the option to his son and say, you do something with it. And it took 10 years, but he eventually, like Roger Corman, made this independently. No studio would touch it. They didn't film this on backlots, so this is not sets. They actually had to find asylum in Oregon and shoot on location with actual patients and live and bunk with them. And crew will tell you sometimes it was hard to tell the difference between actor and patient. Like, it sounds like a really crazy shoot.
Sounds like Jared Leto would have loved to have been on the set.
Yeah, very method. And again, Jack Nicholson is very method. Like, a lot of them were. I mean, I do feel like the 70s was the time that character actors could be leading men. But he was, I guess, you know, we can only imagine Jack Nicholson in this role now, but he was not the first choice. They wanted Brando. They wanted Burt Reynolds. They wanted James Caan. Gene Hackman was the author's choice, but I just can't imagine anybody else. Jack Nicholson is the icon of the wild man 70s anti-hero, and this is his biggest role, right? Like, this is the role that cements that persona.
Yeah, and I have to ask, you know, if this opened up today, people would be upset because they'd be calling it ableist and Twitter would be aflame. But 1975, I get it. We're expanding what we do with films. They're really pushing the boundaries. Is this still seen, though, as somewhat like taboo or having a film like about a bunch of mental ward patients?
Yes. I mean, to be clear, the MPAA had just been created. This language would not have been allowed in a movie 6 years before. So, like, yes, this is raw. This is considered, again, I want to point out, this is not a studio picture. Michael Douglas had to go find music studio money and just go out on his own and hope that somebody would distribute it after they made it. You know, he knew that Jack Nicholson was a big enough star. Chinatown was a hit. He was a leading man, but it was a risk. Almost everyone else here, as we pointed out, are unknowns. And yeah, it's a $4 million production, $1 million of which going to Jack Nicholson. It was a risk and one that paid off handsomely because, yes, as we've already stated, it won everything. It made $100 million at a time when, like, movies, that's as big as a movie could get.
Seventh highest grossing film of all time at that point. If you can imagine $100 million actually being the seventh biggest, I mean, that Jaws was number one.
Yeah, a phenomenon. And again, I think because in 1975, at the tail end of the Vietnam War, and a president that is resigning in scandal, and a general youth culture that didn't believe in the system anymore, you could make a commercial movie that says America is a nut house and the inmates are saner than the people running the place. I think that sentiment was where America was at in 1975. This movie really capitalized on a time and place that it wouldn't have had that advantage if it had come out, certainly with Kirk Douglas, in 1963. Well, Arnie, you love the movie so much, why don't you give us the plot? We can get into it.
Wanting to avoid laboring on a work farm, Randall McMurphy, played by Jack Nicholson, gets himself transferred to a mental institution. There he meets a number of men with various mental disorders, including stuttering, suicidal Billy Bibbit, played by Brad Dourif, What a crap name to be born with if you're a stutterer. Billy Bibbit.
That's the truth. Yeah, you're fucked.
Immature Martini, played by Danny DeVito. Whiny Charlie Cheswick, played by Sidney Lassick. Rageaholic Max Tabor, played by Christopher Lloyd. Deaf Native American Chief, played by Will Sampson, and others. In charge of this group is uptight nurse Mildred Ratched, played by Louise Fletcher. McMurphy instantly becomes the alpha male of the group, but that means he's butting heads with Ratched. She refuses his every attempt to initiate any change, such as watching the World Series, but McMurphy's energy and down-to-earth mindset seems to help the fellow patients more than any of the drugs or group therapy. McMurphy even leads a group breakout from the institution to take the patients on a fishing trip. McMurphy also bonds with Chief, who reveals he's not deaf. He's been faking it the entire time. The two become close friends, and McMurphy tries to convince Chief to leave the Institute with him, but Chief is scared to leave institutionalized life. McMurphy then learns that, as a patient there against his will, he can be held indefinitely as compared to the few months he had left to spend on the work farm. McMurphy plans an escape, but first holds a drunken goodbye party. Virgin Billy becomes infatuated with McMurphy's friend Candy, so the two find a room so she can pop his cherry. Waiting for Billy, everyone falls into a drunken stupor. They're awoken when Ratched arrives at work to see the women, the alcohol, and the mess. In an effort to maintain control, Ratched tells Billy that his mother will hear about what happened. In a panic, Billy slits his own throat with broken glass. Knowing Ratched is the cause of Billy's act, McMurphy loses control and tries to choke the nurse. Seeing him now as a violent inmate, the doctors lobotomize McMurphy. Chief, seeing his friend gone, suffocates McMurphy's body. He then fulfills McMurphy's dream of escape, smashing the windows and running for Canada, as credits roll. And something I always get wrong, I've always thought it's Nurse Ratched.
Ratched.
Yeah, it's Ratched, like wretched, not ratchet, like a socket wrench.
She's not a hatchet, but she is a battle axe. And yes, we see the beginning of this movie is a juxtaposition of her arriving serenely at work, you know, nice linen whites, seeming so matronly, juxtaposed with this police cruiser pulling up and delivering the latest inmate, Randall Patrick McMurphy. Jack Nicholson finally won his Oscar for this. He had been nominated 4 previous times. He was about 6 years into his stardom. And yeah, this is the one that he finally got it for.
Wow, 4 times in only 6 years is a huge amount of nominations.
Oh yeah, it was like an annual thing. When are they going to give it to him? And this was the one.
He gets a great entrance here, though. He's in handcuffs. He's being escorted by the cops. It really makes you wonder, how safe is it for the inmates to have violent criminals there if he needs to be so restrained? Is this whole place criminally insane people? We're going to find out it's not.
It's mostly volunteers.
Yeah, you're mixing the inmates with the clinically depressed.
There's 2 camps, and the book makes this more clear, but there's the acutes that are basically people that are expected to get better, that could have a hope of going back out into the world. And those are the ones that, you know, we focus on. But then there are the chronics, the ones that are bedridden, the ones that are the Hills Have Eyes mutants. They're not getting out. They're not doing anything. And that is Chief. It's worth pointing out that our main character, the one that could be narrating the whole story, Chief Bromden is the first person that McMurphy approaches, and their friendship sort of starts here, but there is no expectation. Everyone else is telling him, oh, he's deaf and dumb, and why are you bother talking to that Native American?
And as you mentioned, they wanted some other actors for this, but you need somebody who can instantly win over the audience. And Jack Nicholson, with his fast talk and his no-bullshit demeanor, he talks to the chief, but he also goes in and talks to the doctor who's in charge of the place, discussing why he's there. Is the question, is he just there because he doesn't want to work? Well, the answer is yes.
Obviously.
Yeah, this does feel a bit like Catch-22. Like, oh, you want to get out of the military? You have to be crazy, but no crazy person's going to ask to go out of the military. Like, it feels like a similar setup. Is he lazy or is he crazy? And I love Jack Nicholson's performance here. It feels like I've seen people like this, that they're just always trying to grift their way through life, and they have a lot of charisma, too. There's a movie that came out last year called Red Rocket that had a protagonist that is awful, but you're also, like, kind of swept up in his charisma, and I'm feeling that with McMurphy as well.
I mean, that's Jack Nicholson all over. It's like how do we tell stories about unlikable people and have audiences pay to see them? Jack Nicholson, like, he's the solution. We love him to do bad things. We love when he goes crazy. We love that he's, like, larger than life. And most of his movies, he's playing a pretty despicable person, or at least severely flawed. And that includes this one. It's worth pointing out that, like, yeah, he is kind of an asshole. You know, belligerent, lazy.
Statutory rapist.
Yeah, statutory rape, physical assaults. Like, you wouldn't want to have a beer with this guy because he'd probably punch you.
He is not even remorseful about that rape. He's like, anyone would have gone after that.
15 going on 35.
Right. Because he can make us laugh about it. That is his talent. He can have us laughing about how they needed to staple his pants together. We laugh at that. And so we forgive all of the misgivings. And I feel like he easily steps into the picture looking heroic to everyone on the floor. Or not just the other inmates, but to the audience. Star making.
But it's also not just Jack Nicholson's personality that carries it a long way. But as you mentioned, he went over and talked to Chief, somebody who everybody else ignored. You know, he's going to pay attention, even if he is going to make racist Indian woo-woo sounds and things. And
yeah, rain dancing and war cries. I'm not sure. Again, this is what I mean about Jack Nicholson. That is so offensive, and yet no one is offended watching him do that. We all laugh.
I mean, it is the 70s, so...
No. No, it's not the 70s. Jack Nicholson could do it today, if he could remember his lines. He could do it today. Some people get a pass, and he's one of those people. He can make awful behavior look charming always.
I think, though, that he treats all of these people with basic respect helps carry that, because the audience could turn on him. You've got to show through more than charisma that he's supposed to be our protagonist and we're going to root for him. And I think, yeah, talking to Chief the way he does when nobody else does, and not caring if he could hear him or not, treating Chief like a human being goes a long way to sell him as the good guy.
Yeah, but I don't know if he's treating everyone with respect. Like, I get a sense of who he is right away. He is this force of chaos. Like, he goes to that pinochle game and he's flashing nudie cards to Martini and distracting him. And, like, it's very funny, though, because, like, you have these very straight-laced inmates and, like, no, we gotta play the game. And, like, he feels like a tornado tearing through this mental ward.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure. You're right. He does talk to the Indian when no one else will. And that will become, really, the bond, the thing that drives the movie. We don't know it, because there's so many people on the ward at the start of this film, but they're a central relationship here. But yeah, I really do think it's more that we appreciate the humor, and we appreciate the fact that this sterile environment where all humanity goes to die is woken up by what he brings in here. He is going to change everyone and everything. And, you know, he's going to be a martyr, too. Like, it'd be one thing if he gets away with it. I think part of why he gets the sympathy is, and this was much clearer in the book, they've really layered on some Christ delusions here. Like, I think, I don't know if it's clear in this movie.
No, I never thought of Christ during it, so no.
Oh, well, yeah, no, this all over here. Yeah, the 12 apostles.
Yeah, definitely dies for the sins, yeah.
Oh, I get that part, but yeah, what other illusions are you speaking of?
Well, he's got 12 apostles that surround him, and I had to count in the movie. I'm like, are there 12?
Okay, I did not count them.
Yeah, but there are. There more or less are. If you count the Hills Have Eyes mutant, there's 12 of them. And yeah, one of them will be Judas and betray him. And again, the language in the book was just, I mean, it's the first novel. What can you do? But like they're always saying, do you think you're a god here? And they've done a really good job of letting that still be a theme here, but not overplaying it the way that it came across on the page. I think that these screenwriters, because they weren't the author, Ken Kesey, they don't feel like they have to go there and overemphasize the religious illusions. But they're all over the place in this movie.
Yeah, I will say in hindsight, looking back on this film, it is a little bit disingenuous and perhaps borderline dangerous to say, oh, all these clinically depressed people need is a good day out. They just need to hang around with the cool kid for a little while and play some blackjack instead of pinochle, and we're gonna make their problems not go away, but we're going to make them better.
Yeah, of course that is not true. And that is why I'm just going to put it out there. This movie doesn't work as a document about mental institutions and where we were at with mental health in 1975. First of all, again, the book was written in 1962 about experiences in 1959. Lobotomy and electroshock therapy, the way that it's going to get portrayed in this movie, they're playing to the audience, right? In 1975, the youth that are going and paying their money to see this picture hate the establishment. Government is bad. They're the crazy ones. It plays to that sentiment. This is a movie that says the crazy people aren't crazy. The people running the show, the domineering mother figure, is the one that you should hate.
I don't know if there is anything in the background material that you read, Stuart, but I don't know if you guys are familiar with the French philosopher Foucault, who wrote, I think in 1960, one of his works, Madness and Civilization. Like, his whole thing was, whatever is considered mentally ill is a social construct, and the madman has had a different role to play throughout civilization, and, you know, this is how we marginalize people. We call it mental illness. There's no real thing as science. It's just whatever we deem, like, we don't want to deal with. So yeah, I guess that's how I approach this, that this, because, look, yeah, I'm not going to take this as a way to actually treat mentally ill people or how to address that problem. To me, it's more like, how are they treated? And some of these people should be able to function just fine, but Reeve said, no, you're a little weird. You need to go in here. Like, McMurphy, okay, he is a statutory rapist and assaultist, but, like, I feel like, yeah, that is someone that's been marginalized society. Modern society just doesn't have a place for that kind of wild, crazy person anymore. So let's throw him in this institution. So I could definitely see how this would fit with that counterculture of the 60s and 70s.
Well, the other thing is, in the 70s especially, and moving on into the 80s, the thought of head shrinkers was a negative one. Psychiatry wasn't viewed as a real profession. You know, you had to go in and get your head shrunk. That really means that what's wrong with you isn't that you're clinically depressed or whatever. It's what's wrong with you is you're falling for this sham science quackery that's going on. And so to portray psychiatry in a positive light is something that wouldn't happen for at least probably another 5 years in mainstream films.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's an institution. Again, I see this all as a metaphor for America. They've locked up the Native American. They rigged the vote. They're running it so that, yes, sane people and people that are just individuals that don't want to follow conformity and rules are thus labeled, branded problems that must be handled. And that's the way that this is going to play. You have to accept that this is one man against the system. And at this time, everyone feels like they're that one man. There is no conformity because Nixon and what was going on in America was so bad that, yes, people felt a release to say, this is all crazy.
Where you're taking this as only a man versus society metaphor falls apart, though, is that many of these patients, the majority of the ones that McMurphy will interact with, are there voluntarily.
Yeah, because they're too weak to understand that they're individuals. They're conforming.
I mean, we see that right away. We get this group meeting with Harding, like, you know, this very fastidious rule follower and some kind of rage going on with his wife. Like, I'm afraid for her.
Probably closet gay. I mean, at this time, it was still, like, in the DSM that homosexuality was mental illness. So that's what's really going on there.
Yeah, but you see this meeting kind of erupt into chaos. I've never really paid attention to this before, but it kind of just focuses on Nurse Ratched and, like, her just staring at, I swear she's almost cracking a smile that she's feeding off this chaos. She likes this.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely the take on this is again, the ones that should be locked up are the ones that are setting the rules. And they really pitched this almost like, I see it as like a father-mother relationship. Jack Nicholson is the, like, good dad that'll let you eat, you know, cake for dinner, and she's the overprotective mother.
Maybe not a good dad, but a cool dad.
Oh, that's a good dad.
Yeah, he's the cool dad that doesn't believe in rules and lets you do whatever you want. And she's the overprotective mother that thinks you can't do anything. And that's because she wants you under her thumb, under her control. She likes order. And everyone is doing what she says in the beginning. It's a problem that Jack Nicholson is here, and one that she wants to fix.
Yeah, watching this for now playing, I started to really deconstruct their relationship, you know, because she's the one who's really in charge, and it is a little bit disappointing that the only female portrayals in this movie are going to be cunts or sluts. And I'm using the term from the movie, the C word, that Jack Nicholson uses to describe Ratched.
Oh, I think you can use the M word. This movie has a misogynist streak. It definitely is saying that you should root for the man, and there is not the same level of consideration for what Ratched is doing. She is, in my mind, I'm curious to hear the argument. To me, she is an all black hat villain. There is really no nuance that what she's doing is in any way not self-serving and cruel.
Well, going into this watch, I had something in my mind where Louise Fletcher had said for a long time she didn't see her character as a villain.
Okay.
So I really tried to look at this movie from the point of view of Nurse Ratched not being a bitch on a power trip, you know?
A castrating female. I mean, let's just call it what it is. She has emasculated all these men.
Literally through chemicals.
I don't know how you reconcile that idea she's not a villain, though, with the end of this. Like, she is a villain by then. Like, there's no other reason why she'd give the guilt trip to Billy.
Yeah, you're right. I can't stay with that. I tried really hard to go with that viewing this time, and I couldn't stick with it. There's just too much she does. But it didn't have to go this way, is basically what I'm saying. I mean, right at the very beginning, McMurphy just barges into the nurse's station to turn down the music after the group therapy. He immediately, his first day there, challenges her authority and does so with logical explanations and reasoning.
I feel like he's logical much of the time, like how he's going about, like trying to watch baseball and all that. And she is just so mean, she will not let it happen. She has to be in control.
And when he won't take her medicine, she's going to bend it over and have him take it some other way. So, yeah, it becomes a battle of wills immediately.
Yeah. I mean, what she says is the music's played loud because the old people can't hear it. But you don't see anyone on this ward enjoying it. Again, no. This is her control. This is her setting the tone for what it is. And yeah, I'm just going to put it out there. For me, it is a problem that there's not any nuance, that I can't see her as a complicated character. She is entirely bad. They have created a super villain here. That said, she's great in it. I mean, yeah. Louise Fletcher, this is just as much a star-making role for her as it is for Jack Nicholson. They looked at other people, more famous people. Angela Lansbury coming off Manchurian Candidate made a lot of sense.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Faye Dunaway, Anne Bancroft, Ellen Burstyn, even Jane Fonda. But they couldn't afford them, really, is I think part of the problem. This, again, is a $4 million movie, $1 million going to Jack Nicholson. There's no room for another big star. So they went with a character actress who had made a Robert Altman movie, and lo and behold, she was the perfect fit for it. She has mastered the idea of, again, you can just see how serene she wants everything to be, the order that she exhibits in the way she carries herself, and then slowly but surely, the way that McMurphy is going to get under her skin. Watching her seethe, there's no way not to enjoy it. Because she is so bad, we love to see her not get her way.
I've got to imagine, like, she's got to be on, like, you know, AFI's top 100 movie villains. She's got to be in the top 10. Like, she... Yeah, it is so bad. And I don't know, that doesn't take anything away. Like, this is a film I've seen a bunch, and, like, my view of her has evolved. Like, yes, now I just see her as, like, so bad and just picking up these little, like, looks and yeah, all those little things she does. Won't turn down the music, all that. Like, this is a film about crazy people, and she's just as crazy.
The way she just purses her lips, she is masterful at the subtle body language, because she doesn't have a whole lot of lines, and what she has are pretty matter-of-fact lines, but the way she delivers them and just the look she gives, the way that she will just stare down McMurphy, and he's not even paying attention to her, which gets under her skin all the more. It is a performance on par with Jack Nicholson, which is what you need if you're going to have a good tête-à-tête.
And Nicholson said something interesting. He only told Louise Fletcher this, but he's like, here's my take on this character. I'm someone that has charmed every woman that I've met, and my tragic downfall is that I can't seduce you. The way they played it is, I don't know if you get butch lesbian or what, but she is in no way finding what he's doing as any way attractive, and he's convinced that he can seduce her the way he does every other woman. And because of that, he ends up where he does.
Huh, I didn't think of it that way. And yeah, there's no chance. I don't think by the end of this movie he thinks he can seduce her, but maybe that's why he's giving up and running for it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a charismatic character, but I never took it as he's trying to seduce her. He's a womanizer. I think he runs around with prostitutes. Like, that's what I think of Candy and Rose at the end. Like, that's what they seem like. So I never got the sense that he was this great womanizer. I mean, he's got to go after 15-year-olds.
But again, it's not just women. I think he thinks he can seduce everybody. I mean, he's got charm, and he's using that. And it's working. Again, we're agreeing to go along with someone that is probably in real life someone we wouldn't want to be around, but in this movie is someone that we're enjoying, and that's Nicholson magic.
Look at our alternatives. Would we want to hang around with anybody in this place? That's one of the things that makes Nicholson so likable in this film, is he's going to treat all of these crazies, these losers, these misfits as normal people. Maybe not equals, because he likes to be on top.
Not equals, yeah. He's going to get on Banchini's shoulders for that basketball game and, like, make him carry around, even though he's crying that he's too heavy. But, yeah, he's going to try to pull them out of their shell. I think it's self-serving, but good could still come from that.
Yes. I definitely think it's clearer in the book. And in fact, Ratchet makes the point that you guys need to notice that he's conning you out of your cigarettes. He's always, like, in pumping you up, it's really to only get what he wants. And there's some real truth to that. I mean, she's got his number, and that he's a manipulator too.
But also let him watch the World Series. Like, those guys really want to see it. Like, maybe it's because he convinced them, but...
Yeah, I don't think anybody there was a baseball fan, but he just got them all talked up with that feeling of normality and of camaraderie.
And something that's happening outside their world. I mean, that's the other thing, is like, originally he talks about taking that sink, busting the window, and running downtown to go see it. And, you know, they're like, well, of course you can't do that. And he does all this drama trying to lift that sink that everyone knows that he can't. The point he's trying to make is you got to try. You got to deny the odds. And yeah, you got to go experience the world. He's coming from outside thinking, I've got to just serve my prison sentence here, and then I'm going to be able to go out and live life again. We're going to find out these people have no ambition to go out. He's teaching them that it's, well, I think it comes more clear when he hijacks the bus that there can be fun to be had in the outside world.
I think if there's a standout of the supporting cast in my mind, this viewing, it's Christopher Lloyd. And it starts during the scene where he's like, everybody's betting a dime, a dollar. Will McMurphy get to go to the bar and watch the game? And here comes Max Tabor. I bet you $25. And he's got a shaved head and just this little smirk. And it's not a mean smirk. It's not like he's anti-McMurphy, but he knows exactly what is involved in trying to lift that. And he seems to be one of the standouts here. And it shows, you know, why Christopher Lloyd would go on to have a huge, if not always illustrious, career.
Tabor is one of the chronics, I believe. And like the way Christopher Lloyd looks, I'm like, yeah, he's probably really hurt someone. Like he looks like he's crazy with that shaved head and those ears that stick out.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with him. Everyone seems to have one thing that's holding them back, and that, you know, we're going to see them all get life lessons. You know, like, obviously the Indian's going to learn to use his voice, and Billy's going to get laid, and Charlie the crybaby is going to stand up for what he wants. Like, everyone has their little thing. Martini on the fishing trip, Danny DeVito, you know, who can't figure out how to play Monopoly, can't figure out how to play blackjack. He's going to catch the biggest fish of the excursion. But, Tabor's the one I'm not sure what they're telling me about him. I couldn't figure out.
I don't think they tell us anything about him.
He's argumentative. I think he's the one...
For sure.
Who's... I put Rageaholic in my plot summary for him when I was trying to give the one characteristic that these people sort of have.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, he... Because he's always placing bets against things, he does seem argumentative.
But as a piece of counterculture, like, the moment it really hits me where I'm like, yes, fight the power is when they go to vote that second time for that baseball game. And it's rigged. Like, yeah, I never thought of this as being political commentary until I'm really watching it this time and paying attention and everything. But yes, the system is rigged against you. Oh, you tied. It was 9-9 and your 10th vote came in too late. I feel like talking about votes coming in late, like, we're still talking about that in 2020. That was a big conversation.
I mean, quite literally, counting votes is a, yes, was an issue. But I think, yeah, just as a sentiment, again, when you consider the fact that statistically, most Americans believed and trusted their government prior to the 1970s and the Vietnam War, and how much that got poisoned and really like turned with the counterculture movement and the failure of the Nixon administration, to be honest, at least in terms of Watergate. And again, what they did in Vietnam as well. I think that they lost a lot of people. And this movie is capturing that outrage.
But I think what really gets her is she thinks that she has the upper hand because it's 9-9 in her mind, whereas the other nine are in no condition to vote whatsoever, although Chief is, but nobody knows it at that point. But McMurphy wins. He's going to go and make his own fun and just pretend like there's a baseball game happening, and everybody's going to be caught up in his infectious telling of the baseball game. And again, Louise Fletcher, just that look of hatred.
So mad.
Just pure spite when she puts those records on and turns them up louder than usual.
Yeah, it's very passive aggressive, the games that they're playing. And yeah, he won the vote, it should be said.
No, the meeting was over. The vote was closed, Stuart.
Yeah, exactly. He had it. Even when he has her, she has ways out of it. You know, well, you didn't count the chronics. Well, I called it into the meeting before you got the chronic vote. So yeah, I mean, it is, you realize, I think that McMurphy is soon going to realize that he can't win in this environment, and that what seems like fun and games here is actually a problem. The man that's in charge, it should be said that Dr. Spivey is wanting to send him back to jail. They're like, we're not going to be able to help you. I think you're faking it. He asks other doctors and they're all like, well, he's sick, but not psychotic. He's, you know,
dangerous.
Yeah, dangerous, but not crazy.
Yeah, I mean, dangerous is prison. Dangerous isn't psych ward. In fact, perhaps you shouldn't be in a psych ward if you're dangerous. But watching it this time, to see that it's Ratched who stands up and wants him here, this is her most evil act in the entire movie. Because she could just get her power back, get her alpha status back by getting rid of him. But she can't just get rid of him. She needs to best him and to break him. And when all of these guys are saying, let's just send him back to prison, she's going to be the one that's like, no, he's mine.
Yeah, and they're castrated too. It's worth pointing out that Spivey is kind of, in the end, even though he has the authority, he's a yes man when it comes to her. She has somehow set the wheels so that she, through passive-aggressive means in the background, I mean, again, it is very much like Manchurian Candidate and Angela Lansbury. She's going to be the one to ultimately call the shots. And trivia fact, Dr. Spivey is actually played by the actual doctor that ran the Oregon State Hospital that they're filming in. That was kind of how he agreed to let them. He liked the book anyway, and he was hoping the movie would show that things have improved psychiatric medicine since it was written. And yes, he's like, give me a part. I don't know, he's pretty good. He doesn't have to do anything but be boring and straight-laced, but I appreciate him as he's hopelessly overrun by both Louise Fletcher and Jack Nicholson.
But now things are going to be escalated from McMurphy's side as well. He's not just going to pretend to see a baseball game. He's going to climb over barbed wire. That has to hurt, right? I mean, he's touching barbed wire. I don't think razor wire was quite a thing back then, but it's not like he's using his coat for protection. He's going to steal the bus with all the patients on it.
I gotta ask, like, I only saw this movie once when it came out in theaters, but maybe because it has Christopher Lloyd and it's about crazy people too.
Yes, I know where you're going.
Is this where they got the idea for Dream Team? Don't they sneak out to go to a baseball game in that one?
It has to be. That's the doctor has convinced his superiors that a baseball game would be therapeutic for them. But the scene where they're all on the boat and McMurphy is introducing each one of the patients as doctor.
Yes, I was cracking up with that. That was funny.
And it was funny because in Dream Team, Christopher Lloyd's psychosis is he thinks he's a psychiatrist. And he's always walking around with the clipboard and everything.
Okay, yes, it's coming back to me.
To be clear, the Dream Team comes, 12 years later and is a very broad comedy that is drawing from the renown of this movie.
With Michael Keaton in the Jack Nicholson role, and I think that's a fair trade.
This movie is making the point that you can't tell the difference between the doctors and the patients. Again, that is the overriding theme here, is who really is crazy. And what they're going to insist time and time again is that it's the administration. It is the people in charge that we should hate and condemn.
And we see McMurphy, he's taking all these people with social anxieties or whatever, and he's getting them to go out and do something, like they're going to learn to drive a boat and cast a rod. And I didn't know you had to stick the hook through the eye of the fish. That seems kind of gruesome, but how to bait a hook and everything.
You don't have to go through the eye, but it helps because then you've got the skull on the hook. And if you don't have the bait on there, well, the fish is just going to pull it off.
I'm glad there's a scientific reason for this, a well-treated and tried way.
And of course, there's a foreshadowing thing happening here, too. I mean, this is going to be his lobotomy.
Yeah, but we do see him, taking these people, half of them self-committed because of whatever issues they have, and he's pulling them out, and they're having a pretty good time, even that boat's out of control.
Yes. Again, this is, and I'm going to use the word simplistic. This is the simplistic message.
I agree.
Yep.
That this movie wants to sell, that we really are just overprotective. We tell people that they're wrong when they're just individualistic. They just want to be free and be who they are, and we tell them they're crazy. And while that may be true, I also think there is something called mental illness, and some people benefit by being under psychiatric care. And this movie's simplicity doesn't allow for that nuance, which is why Louise Fletcher is as one note as she is.
Yeah, I agree. This is not a accurate portrayal, but again, to me, it's a metaphor. It's not really about, well, maybe it's a little bit about the state of mental health in our country and how we treat them. But it's not about what should be done. This is not a prescriptive film.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think it trades in that. And don't get me wrong. The history of psychiatric medicine is full of terrible decisions and things that are cringy. And there's reasons why people hate quacks and think that they're head shrinkers. I mean, again, lobotomies, that got a Nobel Prize. That's so awful to think about. But they weren't that common by this point. And I do think this movie tries to overplay the sanitarium nightmare of everything, which might have been more true when the book was written than in 1975 when this movie is released, particularly when it comes to electroshock therapy. Once we get this fight that's going to get McMurphy zapped, I feel like they want to make it look like it's just cruel torture. Like that people shock you just because, this is the way that they hurt people that have individualistic characteristics.
But they do still do electroshock as one of the shocking, no pun intended, things to me.
Oh, for sure. Under sedation.
Yes.
Under sedation. And they know the proper voltage. They do. Yes, in the early days, it was kind of just go full throttle and see. My mom actually did it. So she told me a lot about how it had changed.
You can't keep your hand on the chin of the person getting zapped, right? You're going to get electrocuted too. It's going to conduct.
I wouldn't do it.
That's why in hospitals, they always yell clear before they zap somebody's chest, right? But I couldn't find anything definitive that said lobotomies aren't performed anymore. I got that a lot of them are shunned and they were banned in Russia before they were banned here.
They aren't. Legally, they are not. They were more or less faded out by the end of the 50s. That was, it's very uncommon. They were very popular in the early 40s and late 30s.
But is this movie taking place in the 70s or the 60s?
hard to say, right? Because yeah. I think they want you. The book is written in 1962 and speaks to that, and they're adapting the book, but I think they're really trying to capture the moment of 1975, and they don't want you to think that it's happening in a previous time period.
And is your objection, Stuart, because this is set in a clinical setting in this institution? Because for me, yeah, that is the setting, but that's not what this is about. This is about what the man does to keep you down, man. And so, yeah, this is all parable or metaphor or whatnot. Like, it's hard for me to see this as an indictment of the mental facilities at the time. I mean, it could be a little bit, but I don't know. Maybe because that's a weaker interpretation, it doesn't quite stand up for me. I kind of shun that and go more for just like, yeah, this is the power structure. This is a metaphor for those in power and how they try to keep the marginalized people down.
I think it's a ding on this movie that it plays in a more simplistic manner than it could have. I mean, that's all that I'm saying. I'm not disliking this movie. Let me be clear. I like this movie a lot, but I feel manipulated.
Okay, I get that.
In the same way that Jack Nicholson is feeling manipulated by Louise Fletcher, I'm feeling like this movie is pushing my buttons.
I agree with that, but I don't feel it's in an obvious way. I hate it when I know the movie is trying to manipulate and pull on my heartstrings. And here, I don't see it as obvious. And while I agree with you that it's overly simplistic in its depiction of mental health care, I think that's a good thing for this movie and the aims it wants to have. And I think that you get to be a hugely popular film by having clear-cut good guys and bad guys. And if we started to get into that gray area, you're just going to muddy this thing.
This has moments like every time the chief will like just give a smile because he actually understands what McMurphy's telling him, or, you know, raises that hand. Like, I'm like, yes, like, is that manipulative? Like, yeah, they're going for those cheer moments. But I think it's because they've written characters that I care about. Like, I like these characters, even though they're crazy. So, yeah, maybe some of the emotional stuff they're going for is a little easy. But because I like these characters, I want to cheer for them. I'm looking for those moments.
Absolutely. Again, this is a big hit. This is a big commercial. Like, who would think that a movie set in an insane asylum is going to be popular with general audiences? But this movie is a big hit because it understands how to get you to root for people and then delivers these moments like, yes. Can you imagine if this movie had been narrated by the Indian the whole time? We would not have the joy of that moment where they're sitting there waiting to be shocked and he says, juicy fruit. I mean, like, yeah. This is such yes. a great moment that the screenwriters understood this is how to reveal that. We already knew that he was learning. He had a triumphant moment on the basketball court earlier where he learned how to, you know, score through the net and even hold the net so that the orderlies couldn't make their shots.
I think that's illegal. I think that's goaltending, but I'll give it to him.
Yeah. But we were cheering for him then. But this is, again, really, you don't realize it the first time, but watching it in any other time, you realize how much you love the bromance of Chief and McMurphy.
Yeah, I'd forgotten exactly how much of that this movie was. That I'll never forget the end of this movie from the first time I saw it. But the reason that built up to that, the camaraderie between the two of them, even though Chief didn't get to go on the boat trip, he was left behind for that. He had to just help Murphy get out of there. But yeah, once they get back and have to go to the electroshock together and everything, it is really the two of them, but he won't go. McMurphy is planning a final escape. He's going to get the hell out of there and go to Canada.
Yeah, which, you know, at that time, going to Canada was
dodging the draft.
Right. We know what that means. The fact that McMurphy has tried to get out of his prison sentence by pretending he's crazy is now running to Canada. The Vietnam themes are really heavy here.
It's also a movie taking place in Oregon, so Mexico would be a little bit far.
And I feel like this is where we start to get the Chief's backstory, because is he a volunteer or not? Like, I feel like this is very ambiguous, at least in the movie.
No, he's a chronic, for sure.
He's a chronic, okay. So he tells a story like his dad drank himself blind and was a big man that ended up feeling small, and now he feels small. How did he end up here? Does he say in the book?
Yeah, there's a lot of his story in the book, and he's of mixed race. It should be said he had a white mother, and they talked about all of that. But basically, again, he is having hallucinations, so you can never quite know. But he is believing that McMurphy is is bigger than him and that he's tiny.
So that's a literal thing. Like, he's hallucinating that they're different sizes.
Exactly. He doesn't recognize that he's this giant and it is McMurphy. And it should be said, in the book, McMurphy is big and red-haired and covered in scars and tattoos and all of that. So not physically described like Jack Nicholson. But yes, he looks up to McMurphy and doesn't recognize his own weight and his own size. And part of that is because of what America has done to the Native American, right? I mean, it's the metaphor. We've locked you up. We've jailed you. We've taken away your culture. We've reduced you to a silent presence in the background when this was your country.
But before McMurphy's going to go, he's going to make the biggest mistake of his life. He's going to throw a rager.
A Last Supper. I mean, this is, again, getting back, they're going to decorate for Christmas. And again, like, I really feel like this is, the religious allusions are here. And yeah, his shining buddy is complicit in all this.
Yeah, is Scatman one of the Roman guards in this metaphor?
You just can buy him with some, like, a bottle of booze, $20, and maybe some flirtation with Rose or candy.
We haven't talked much about him, but Billy throughout this, Brad Dourif. It actually says at the beginning, and introducing Brad Dourif.
Oscar nominated, supporting actor.
Was he nominated for this? Because yep. I'm like, this should have got the big six. Like, he is so good in this.
He is, and he's not an actor I think of as being good. You know, I think of him as being Chucky or Wormtongue.
Yeah, usually he's creepy.
Or, God help me, Graveyard Shift as the Exterminator.
Don't go there. Let's stop his career here, where it's like, he's so young and good-looking and sweet, and I feel so bad for him. Again, that overbearing mother that's alluded to by Ratchet. Mm-hmm. Like, I am so taken by this character in this film.
Oh, yeah.
He was up against George Burns, and George Burns had never won before, so...
For Oh God or something?
The Sunshine Boys. Neil Simon.
Okay.
But... Yeah, when I was in high school, A, I didn't know this was Chucky. But B, I felt Billy was my avatar, you know, kind of the shy guy, a little bit depressed, domineering mother. I really felt for Billy. And so here at the end, when Billy and Candy are going to go off into a room together, I'm like, yes, a happy ending in more than one way for Billy. He deserves that.
He's Judas, though. He's going to be the one to rat Mac out. Like, this started on the boat. It should be said that he was trying to approach Candy on the boat, and Jack Nicholson took her down below. It was like, sorry, left him up there on the deck.
Yeah, what is his deal like? Is he's like severely codependent? Because the story we get, like, he proposed to some girl, and either the mom was mad or he got rejected by her and he tried to kill himself. Like, it feels like he falls in love very quickly.
Yeah, I think he proposed to her before he spoke to her. He lives in his mind. And so that makes him crazy or whatever. But again, he's here on a volunteer basis because he just can't adjust to the world. And here's a mother figure that's happy to dominate. And, you know, like, Louise Fletcher is happy to keep him there under her apron strings. It's Jack Nicholson that's going to be like, okay, I'm going to hold up my flight from justice and let you be with my girl and lose your virginity. And it's what cost him, sort of. Although I wonder, you know, we have this moment where Jack Nicholson has unlocked the window, could leave. It's called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. We're all thinking he's going to be the one to get away. But he just kind of sits there and smiles and the camera hangs for a long minute. And it made me wonder... Maybe he doesn't want to go either. As badly as he hates the abuse, nobody out there is going to love him as much as these people here.
Yeah, I agree that, like, he loves how much all these fellow inmates with them, like, kind of have, yeah, made him their messiah, their king. But I also feel like it is his vice that is his downfall. He gets drunk and passes out. Like, that window is open the whole night. He could have left at any time, and it's because he wants to booze it up and help get Billy laid. Like, that is his downfall. He's his worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I no part of me thinks he actually wanted to stay there. He stayed there for Billy, and then, yeah, everybody just fell asleep because they were really drunk. And, you know, I would have thought Billy would have only been a minute or two.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Again, look at that shot. Look at that shot, though, in the way that it hangs on Jack Nicholson smiling after he's opened that window. There seems to be hesitation. Even he, we know the chief is saying, I don't think I can go. Even in him, it was the first time it had ever occurred to me, but it made me think that, you know what? It's never going to be as good for him anywhere else.
I just felt bad for the Hills Have Eyes guy because, like, he's got an IV or something and they're just filling it up with alcohol. It's like going straight down his throat. Like,
yeah.
He has a name, Michael Berryman. Not the mutant, not the Hills Have Eyes guy. Michael Berryman. He's very nice.
He's the Hills Have Eyes guy.
I want people to know who he is. Michael Berryman doesn't mean anything. The character's name is Ellis, if you prefer that, but nobody's going to know that.
I was surprised he was in this. I wrote down, oh, that guy looks like the Hills Have Eyes, and then it was actually him.
Yeah. But yes, what happens is that they're caught. You know, they already were kind of caught. The night nurse already walked in on Scatman and the hooker, but, you know.
That look Scatman has when he, like, looks at the nurse's room that he's sitting in and it's, like, been totally trashed. Like, I'm like, yeah, why are you, like, just leave. Like, you're done for.
Yeah, I don't think he got to keep his job.
Yeah, everyone chooses to stay and drink and face the consequences of what you never want to see, which is Louise Fletcher walking in and seeing the mess you've made and now taking control. And yeah, Washington, that's a metaphorical title right there, is ready to kick McMurphy's ass and not let him leave the window. And everyone's going to be washed up and cleaned up. And it would all go back to normal if she had not shamed Billy.
Yeah, Billy's missing and
she shamed him. He wasn't missing. She told him, I'm going to tell your mother.
Well, you know, he was missing and then they found him in the room with Candy. And that's when, yeah, she's like, I'm going to tell your mom. Like, that is like, I'm going to tell your mom. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, again, this is her authority. This is the way that she sees her power. Like, yeah, it's not a kind portrayal of mental health givers, to say the least.
And I totally feel McMurphy's rage. Like, when they find out Billy has committed suicide, like, he full on rage, like, tackles Ratched, choking her. I'm like, yes, kill her. Like, yeah, okay, is this a commercial film? Because I'm, like, rooting for the hero. It's like, yeah, that's not really about mental illness and what these people go through. Because I'm like, yes, kill the villain of this film now. I want her choked to death.
I would be more okay with him being lobotomized if he had at least taken her down with him.
Killed her? Yes.
To be fair, Billy did sort of rat out McMurphy. I mean, like, just before all of that, I mean, I know he was buckling under pressure, but he was the one that basically said, this is the guy that made me do it. I didn't want to. And so, you know, it's bad for everyone. It's just a bad moment. And yes, it is. I feel uncomfortable about how much I want Jack Nicholson to choke Louise Fletcher.
But I always, every time I watch this movie, I end up with tears in my eyes over Billy's body. Even though that blood looks pretty fake on the ground there.
In high def, yeah, it looks real fake.
But I'm so sad. I mean, he had to break something and just slit his own throat so that his mother didn't find out that he'd had the best night of his life. I mean, that is just, oh man, Billy, I'm always going to feel bad for Billy, and I get it. I get why McMurphy snapped, is this was like a surrogate little brother or surrogate son to him that just killed himself. Yeah, the fact that we're going to end this movie with Nurse Ratched still in control, still with that shit-eating smile, but a neck brace.
It's a tragedy. I mean, just worth pointing out, this is not as commercial as it has seemed. They're not going to give us a happy ending. And again, I think that it is a real shocker. Jack Nicholson being the only real star in this movie, he would be the one to get out of this cuckoo's nest. The fact that he comes back, and there's rumors, you know, they're playing cards for a minute. The men hear that he's escaped. It's a real devastating to the chief. When he goes to the bed and there's Nicholson, you know, drooling on himself, there will be no escape for the two of them.
And Chief doesn't realize at first. He's like, I knew you wouldn't go without me. And he went, but not out.
You know, I got to say, I get we want to have the Indian have the moment here and it's special that it's his. But Tom Tom's in the flute as he's killing the guy, maybe a little much, maybe just a little, like, bring down the Indian stuff a little.
I mean, it is kind of jarring. Like, if you're watching this for your first time, you're going along Jack Nicholson's journey. He's the protagonist of this film. And all of a sudden, the last 5 minutes, it's about the chief. And yeah, that music, but it's a great moment. Like, I almost wish I knew more about the chief. Like, this seems like it would be a better moment if I just knew a little bit more about him. And because all of a sudden he's escaping and lifting that drinking fountain, that sink, whatever that thing is, to smash the window. I don't know. I wish he was a little bit more developed. This would feel a little bit more triumphant for me.
I think it's enough. Again, he's the most developed of all of the other, I call them the apostles, but the acutes. You know, like, he's the one that I think that we've seen had the most connection. I don't know, Arnie, you're making the case for Billy. He got lost in the shuffle for me. I'll be honest. I feel like his death does feel like it comes way at the end. I wasn't paying attention to his story the same way that I did Chief. And are they never going to hire a night watchman that's worth anything? Like, an idiot can break the window and walk away and everyone is screaming and like, nobody? No, there's no security?
They just fired Scatman. They haven't hired a new person yet. They're on their own.
Oh, and for some reason this time, all I could do was hear the end of an officer and a gentleman when, you know, with everybody cheering as Richard Gere comes and takes her off the work floor. That was going through my head during the chief running away scene. You know, the guy who played Chief isn't really that much of an actor. They hired him just because they found a really big Native American. But he does good here. I like him here. I think that he really sells this final scene.
He's better here than Poltergeist 2, agreed. And funny you should mention that, but the guy that did the score here also did go on to write the score for Officer and a Gentleman.
I wonder if I picked something up there. Like, although I think they were playing Love Lift Us Up Where We Belong when it happened in Officer and a Gentleman.
Were there tom-tom drums in...
Yeah. I don't think there was any of this, like, theremin and, yeah, tom-toms.
So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Jacob.
I mean, there are some minor quibbles I could make about this film. I think I've mentioned them. None of them are ruinous or that distracting. It's when I'm going to sit down and really look at this film. Okay, maybe this character could have been a little bit more developed or whatnot. But I think the genius of Milos Forman here is what we talked about with Amadeus, where a stodgy period piece, and he made it about an 80s rock star. And yeah, this could have been a real dour film about people in a mental institution being abused, and he somehow makes that really fun. Like, he got Jack Nicholson, who's just got so much charisma, and I like almost all these inmates, even with all their quirks. Like, every time I get to see Danny DeVito's Martini smile, like, he has an infectious little smile. I love Brad Dourif in here. Like, he has taken, I don't know, maybe it says something about me that I like these characters that are a little bit crazy, but he's made them palatable, and you want to see them, and you want to root for them. And so, again, for me, this isn't so much about, oh, this is the state of how we treat people with mental illness in this country. Like, maybe that's a little bit there, but I get more into, yeah, the counterculture thing. This is about people trying to, you know, nonconformists fight the system and fight the power, and maybe you can't always fight that power. To me, that's how this movie works best. But yeah, the power of it is that there's so many likable characters that shouldn't be likable, but you want to go on their journey, you want to root for them, and strangely feel good. I don't know, you do have what happens to Jack Nicholson in this, but like, again, I have positive emotions that I wouldn't usually associate in this kind of setting. And so for me, that is what's great about this film that I would highly recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, the word that helped me make sense of all of this, because it was a struggle of just like, I'm not buying this, but I am falling for it, is what I kept feeling. I'm like, I'm really feeling this movie, but I don't believe it as a statement about mental institutions in 1975. Fable. This is an excellent fable about America. It's not truth, but boy, it feels true when you see the man trying to stick it to the system and getting all these people to get a backbone, stop being conformist, and stand up for themselves for once. I'll be honest, there are quibbles here, and the biggest one is that I'm just a little uncomfortable with the misogyny of portraying mental health caregivers as these domineering mothers who have no redeeming qualities and want to castrate all fun-loving men. I think that you gave Nicholson too much of a glow and her too much of a villainous role. But again, fable. It's okay to do that in a fable.
You got to have a Wicked Witch.
She is an excellent Wicked Witch. The lion's share of the success of this movie, though, has to be Nicholson, who is working at the height of his powers as a wild man icon of the 70s. He did it many times, starting in Easy Rider. But this is, if not his best movie, his most essential and searing performance. I mean, I think I prefer Chinatown or Shining or The Last Detail.
Am I the only one that likes Five Easy Pieces?
Yeah, I don't like that movie.
Oh, okay.
But if you only see one Jack Nicholson movie, this is one to see. I also just want to praise the screenwriters. This is a case for me where the movie's so much better than the book. And people will tell you that book's a classic. Maybe it is, but I feel like they took the best stuff. They really finessed all that religious allusions that came off so heavy-handed in the book and just improved everything by structuring it in a way that really had a feel-good quality. Some of that's Milos Forman, too, who was not an A-list director but became one because of this film. Cameraman Haskell Wexler. This movie looks beautiful, even though it's in a sterile environment. Many have tried to copy this. I don't think that I can think of a better version of this kind of story. When I think about, like, Cool Hand Luke, you know, Paul Newman kind of made this movie 10 years before.
Great film.
Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams, takes a lot from this 10 years later.
Another great film. Listen to our review in the archives.
And God help me, Shawshank Redemption, which is a film I hate. There's someone epically failing to make One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Because this had a record player playing classical music, I did think of Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, you should, in all kinds of ways. That's a movie that tells you the inmates are innocents and the institution is awful. But it's so lame. But anyway, I've covered that movie. I've processed that movie. This is, if you're ready for a fable, this is about as good as it gets. And it's a high recommend.
And it's a strong recommend from me as well. I think that this is a movie that just works on multiple levels. You don't have to overthink this movie to just come in and have a great time watching Jack Nicholson get one over on the administration and help a bunch of guys out of their shell. Yeah, like those movies Stuart mentioned, it's a evergreen theme that never gets old. And this is one of the absolute best interpretations of it ever. Nicholson is electric on screen here. I can't believe just when his laugh comes out of nowhere and he's trying to have a camaraderie with that doctor who is not really having it, and the interplay with Nurse Ratched and Louise Fletcher. It had to be intimidating to go up against Jack Nicholson, and Louise Fletcher does it so well here. I think if you see one Jack Nicholson movie, see The Shining. But if you see two Jack Nicholson movies, see The Shining and see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And thank you so much, Sean. I haven't rewatched this film in a few years, and it was just such a great joy to go back and do it again. And yeah, it tugs at the heartstrings at the end, but in a way that made me really endeared to this film. So yeah, a strong recommend.
Well, good. 3 for 3. Now, do you want more? Because no, they never made a sequel. The Indian in Canada just didn't have the same appeal. But they did make a prequel series. Ryan Murphy put on Netflix just last year, Ratched. And it's kind of wretched. But have you guys seen it?
I've heard of it, but I haven't heard anything good about it. So no, I never watched it.
I haven't even heard of it. This is sounding terrible.
Yeah. Are they going to make her sympathetic? Are they going to tell us why she's such a jerk?
No. That I wanted. That's what I wanted. More nuance to her, please.
Is she going to be like one of those nurses that kills the patients and goes from hospital? Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yes. It is a horror series with severed limbs and incest.
Are you serious?
No, yeah. They've even got like Hitchcockian music. Like, it feels more like a prequel to Psycho than it does to Cuckoo's Nest. They have completely misrepresented Ratched. Like, I can't believe. It's Sarah Paulson, who I think is a good actress, but it's Ryan Murphy, who I just feel like he's always wanting to. He's so in love with pushing boundaries that his stuff oftentimes feels campy and just ridiculous. And this one, yeah, it's just one big catfight where Sarah Paulson is, you know, like fighting with Sharon Stone, who's a mother who like has a son that all his limbs have been carved off, like Hannibal kind of stuff here.
That sounds bizarre.
Yeah, it's 8 episodes that I'll never get back. I tried to watch it when it premiered, didn't get through 2. But I did push myself to see if they ever did at least get her to the cuckoo's nest. But no, her incestuous brother and her are fighting in Mexico for season 2. I'm out. Peace. Nope, not doing it. Nothing to do with the book. Nothing to do with this movie. And a real shame that they were allowed to take, yes, a character that is wonderfully villainous, but human.
I mean, that is the popular thing. Cruella, like, take someone that's a black and white villain. And, you know, Cruella is literally black and white, but you know what I mean? Just like no nuance and try to give him a sympathetic backstory. Do that with Joker. Like, that seems to be the popular thing. I'm shocked that's not what it is.
Because Ryan Murphy just isn't that kind of writer. And I mean, the people that are, he created the show, but other people are writing it. Like, it's art directed to the hilt. Of course, it looks great. It's expensive, but it just a lousy, terrible show. And yeah, they said that they greenlit a second season. I guess it was a hit, but I won't be there. No way. And if you like this movie, avoid.
Neither. I'm glad I avoided it. And wow, that sounds terrible.
Terrible is the word. Wretched is my review.
So that is it for our patron shows for May. We will be back next month with one I've never heard of. We're reviewing Love, Simon.
Yeah, it's Gay Pride Month, so why not do a romantic comedy made for kids about two boys in love?
Oh boy, we can't play it in Florida.
Yeah, I can't release this in Florida.
Yeah, right. And if that's not homoerotic for you, we'll also be reviewing Top Gun 2 before we get there.
Will there be another volleyball scene? Will it be even more homoerotic?
There is. There is a volleyball scene. It's in the trailer.
Can't wait for both. So hope to see you there for, yeah, I haven't seen Love, Simon either, but we'll cover that one in 3 weeks. And if you want more Jack Nicholson, over on the main feed, we're covering Chinatown, which is the big movie he made right before One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And its sequel next week, little known, I think few people saw it, The Two Jakes.
So thank you, Sean, for donating. Thank you to all you patrons for pledging and supporting our show. We hope you've enjoyed having a month with a double dose of bonus podcasts. And until next time, gentlemen, the meeting is adjourned.
You fooled him, Chief. You fooled him. You fooled them all.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
A little change never hurt, huh? A little variety.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
I'm not just talking about one person, I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about form. I'm talking about content. I'm talking about interrelationships. Do you understand? Finally!
And a special thanks to Sean for his incredible support of the show and for picking One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for our hosts to review.
He's got intelligence!
Wait a minute.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
You just don't want to listen to anybody.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
Get out of my way, son. You're using my oxygen, you know what I mean?
Now Playing is edited by Heath and Arnie.
I'm tired of a lot of baloney.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
I ain't talking to him. I'm talking to myself. It helps me think.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
It's a fucking lie. Why don't you give him a cigarette?
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Rules? Piss on your fucking rules, Mr.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I'm gonna miss you very much, man.
Yeah, well, back then, they wanted to know what this whole acid thing was and whether they needed to arrest Timothy Leary or not.
You just got to be careful because your daughter will be able to start fires with her mind if you do it.
People might not know what that means now that they've made the remake. Well, Arnie, you love the movie so much. Why don't you give us the plot? We can get into it.
I thought you were going to tell him to marry it if he loved it so much.
Ha, Pee-wee joke.
He was up against George Burns, and George Burns had never won before, so...
For Oh God or something?
The Sunshine Boys. Okay. Neil Simon.
Yeah, it would be supporting actor. I guess Burns was supporting in Oh God, but it feels like you'd give him lead.
It's not Oh God. It's not Oh God.
I know, I was just saying it wouldn't be Oh God. It happened in Officer and a Gentleman.
Were there tom-tom drums in...
Yeah, I don't think there was any of this, like, theremin and, yeah, tom-toms.
And no, I'm not subtly dropping hints that we should review An Officer and a Gentleman, listeners.
Yeah, I've seen it once. I don't want to see it again.
Never seen it.
Never seen it? All right, now I'm changing my mind. Somebody please donate for this.
It's not on my list. I can say I can honestly think of 300 movies I'd see before that.
Woo!